Hello, and coming up tonight on the Indie Global Report is, of course, the International Middle East Media Centre, this week's in Palestine weekly roundup of occupation statistics in the West Bank and Gaza. News of Reclaims the Future's shutdown by Killjoy Islington Police. We have Free the Peeps in the studio for a report back on London's biggest party poopers. Congolese refugees deported to unsafe Democratic Congo Republic. News on protests in solidarity with the refugees there. Tesco's disrespect for First World War veterans in Shepton Mallet. And the Met Police's attempt to appeal Critical Mass's High Court victory. We speak to Supermassa Des K about the freedom to ride our bikes where we like, with as many people as we like, when we like.
Indie Media Global Report on Resonance FM 104.4. Check out www.indiemedia.org.uk.
In a democracy, the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders, the general population, have to be kept from interfering. They can be spectators, but not participants.
No matter how much legal action you put behind this, people are going to do what they want to do.
Spectators, but not participants.
Before this victory won, some will have to get thrown in jail some more, but we shall overcome.
It's time to talk about censorship.
This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for March the 24th through the 30th, 2007.
The Arabs relaunched their five-year peace offer to normalize relations with Israel. Israel rejects the deal. Meanwhile, the Palestinians commemorate the Land Day. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
Let's begin our weekly report on nonviolence in Belain on Land Day. On March 30, 1976, Palestinians in Sakhnin and Arabeh in northern Israel organized a general strike and various demonstrations in protest against the Israeli authorities' decision to confiscate Palestinian land in the Galilee. The Israeli army and police responded very violently to the protest and killed six Palestinian residents of Israel. The land confiscation is a result of what is called the Absentee Property Law of March 1950. According to this law, Israel transferred the right of owners of the land to a custodian of absentee property. It was used to confiscate lands belonging to over 700,000 Palestinian refugees who were expelled from Palestine in 1948. It was also used to confiscate the lands of Arab citizens of Israel who are present inside the state, yet classified in law as absent. The central theme for this year's Land Day focuses on Israel's illegal wall. Though Israel claims the wall is being built for security reasons, the wall annexes the land it seizes into Israel, and illegal Israeli settlements are built on the appropriated land, forcing Palestinians who once lived and worked on the land into ghettos. Belain, a Palestinian village outside the central West Bank city of Ramallah, has become a symbol of nonviolent resistance to Israeli apartheid. Villagers and internationals have been standing in solidarity for over 2 years in Belain, demonstrating against the completed wall, which has stolen over 60% of the land from the village. This Friday, the village of Belain conducted its weekly demonstration against the illegal wall being built by Israel. The villagers, along with Israeli and international supporters, marched towards the gate in the illegal wall, separating the village from its land. As soon as the demonstration arrived at the gate, soldiers fired tear gas canisters, sound bombs, and rubber bullets at them, injuring 10. Among the injured were two reporters. Towards the end of the demonstration, the Israeli soldiers chased some local stone-throwing youths into the village and fired tear gas into residents' houses, causing several casualties amongst women and children. All were treated on the spot by medics.
Around 200 protesters marched in the village of Salamone, south of Bethlehem, to protest the construction of the wall on their land and to commemorate the 31st anniversary of Land Day. Protesters, including Palestinians, internationals and Israelis, carried signs and banners and chanted slogans calling for the removal of the wall, describing it as land theft that is killing Palestinian life. No clashes erupted with the soldiers as the protesters remained non-violent. Provocative moves by some of the protesters were stopped by the organisers. Casey, an American protester, spoke to IMEMC.
It seemed like a protest against the wall and the restriction of freedom of the people of Palestine. But what I saw that was very inspiring was it looked like some people wanted to become more aggressive, but they were stopped and kept it very peaceful and quiet. It looked like the Palestinians stopped it themselves, and I don't know what level it, you know, whoever, what, it looked only like a couple people, but that's all it takes, I guess.
The crowd arrived at the mosque of the village, where some speeches relating to the land day were made. The speakers stressed the importance of non-violent resistance in protecting the land from being confiscated by the Israeli army. A large amount of the village of Salamona and the nearby villages has been confiscated for the construction of the wall and the expansion of the Israeli settlement of Ephrata. In Kafin, a village north of Tulkarem city in the northern part of the West Bank, the apartheid wall has existed since 2003. On Friday midday, a demonstration started with speeches and then demonstrators walked a 10-minute march to the site of the wall, where Israeli soldiers met the 500 participants. The village, along with Israeli and international supporters, tried to cross the gates of the wall to get to the village land, which is trapped on the other side. Soldiers used batons to hold them off. The protest ended when clashes erupted between local youths using stones and Israeli soldiers using sound and tear gas bombs, along with rubber-coated metal bullets. No injuries were reported.
Active diplomacy efforts defined the week, highlighted perhaps most by the Arab League summit held this Wednesday in the Saudi city of Riyadh. Arab leaders took the opportunity to reaffirm their commitment to the five-year-old Arab Peace Initiative. The 2002 peace proposal calls for normalization with Israel in return for full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, as well as a just solution for the Palestinian refugees in the diaspora. Israeli Foreign Minister Tzipi Livni responded with a flat-out refusal and a call to amend the peace plan. She dismissed the idea of withdrawal to 1967 borders, as well as the return of Palestine refugees to the borders of historical Palestine, now called Israel. A similar refusal was uttered by the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and his Vice Premier Shimon Peres. Sergio Yanni, an Israeli political analyst, says Israel is using the issue of the Palestinian refugees to reject the Arab Peace Initiative.
Israel is not giving to give up anything. Israel is not ready to take out the settlements, and Israel is not ready to go back to the borders of 1967. But Israel is using the refugees in order to reject the Arab initiative. Knowing that the question of refugees is a core question for the peace process, Israel is trying to avoid the Arab initiative, which is a very powerful one, through abusing the issue of the refugees.
The United States welcomed the Arab move regarding the peace proposal and described the outcome of the summit as very positive regarding a peace settlement between the Arab world and Israel. Palestinians, on their part, welcomed the relaunch of the Arab initiative as a method to end the conflict. Samir Jaber from Bethlehem says the initiative is generally accepted in the Palestinian street.
The Arab summit came up with a proposal that matches the official Palestinian stance. Therefore, it is accepted by the mainstream Palestinians. So it falls within the lines of the Palestinian understanding of dealing with the Arab-Israeli conflict.
During her visit to the region last week, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice urged Arab leaders to follow up on the Arab plan and use it as a basis to engage with the Israelis. Earlier this week, Rice met with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to discuss the two-state solution and the roadmap. President Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert agreed to hold biweekly meetings, but their subject matter has yet to be agreed upon. Abbas hopes to focus on negotiations for a final solution rather than humanitarian concerns. But Rice is de-emphasizing final solutions, focusing instead on what she calls a common agenda between Israelis and Palestinians, that is, humanitarian concerns. Meanwhile, United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon took his first trip to Palestine since taking office. Ban met with Palestinian officials and residents of Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem. Ban did not meet with Hamas ministers. However, he did welcome the newly established Palestinian Unity Government and encouraged it to comply with the international community's demands. These demands include the recognition of Israel and the renunciation of violent struggle. Ban Ki-moon also expressed sorrow over Israel's annexation wall, observing that it has prevented Palestinians from leading normal lives. The International Quartet of Middle East Peace has also decided to continue the economic boycott of the Palestinian Authority until the new cabinet recognizes Israel and renounces violence. but the quartet, which is composed of the United States, the United Nations, the European Union, and Russia, has approved a temporary assistance mechanism through which the quartet members have pledged to assist the Palestinian people for the next 3 months, with possible extension of such assistance in the long term. Amid these developments, the United Nations has criticized Israel for not allowing access of fact-finding missions into the occupied Palestinian territories for the verification of Israeli crimes and human rights violations against the Palestinian people. While UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is still imposing demands on the new Palestinian government, it has received assurances from several European countries, including Norway, Austria, Italy, Germany, and France.
The collapse of a septic tank resulted in tragedy in Umm al-Nasr village in the northern Gaza Strip on Tuesday. 5 people were killed and several wounded. IMEMC's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
Medical sources report that 5 Palestinian residents, including women and children, died and 17 others were wounded when a cesspool collapsed in the Bedouin village in Beit Lahia, north of Gaza. It collapsed abruptly as it has been wakened by use and reported damage sustained during the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Dr. Muawiyah Abu Hassanin describes the impact of the sewage tank failure.
بالنسبة لعدد الوفيات بالقرية البدوية هو 5 وعدد
As for the death toll in the Bedouin village, it is 5, while the injured who have been admitted to hospitals, including the Kamal Edwan and Al-Shefa, are 17. A state of emergency has also been declared in the health ministry's hospital and the primary health care clinics.
Abu Safra, who lost his mother and nephew in the incident, told IMEMC that village residents had complained to local authorities that a collapse was likely.
A neighbor of mine saw some water leaking from the cesspool, so he informed those in charge. Yet officials responded by claiming that the actual life of the structure would hold up for another month. We call on our brothers to come here and see the misery the Bedouin village has just suffered.
The Bedouin village, called Umm al-Nasr, was established by the Palestinian Authority on Israel-Gaza northern border line in 1999 for Palestinian Bedouins, majority of whom are shepherds or manual laborers. The village is made up of cottages and has water and electricity networks run by the local municipality. Local government said the collapse of the cesspool has caused complete destruction of 60 cottages and has partially damaged 226 others. The Palestinian Environment Authority has repeatedly warned officials in Umm al-Nasr municipality of a likely humanitarian disaster should the weakened cesspool fail. It had come under Israeli gunfire prior to the Israeli disengagement in 2005. Kamil Abu Qaida is the secretary of Umm al-Nasr municipality.
We were surprised at 9:30 yesterday morning that a 6.5-acre large cesspool containing 20,000 cubic meters of sewage water collapsed. The problem of sewage water disposal is not only faced by the municipality or the village of Umm al-Nasr, it is also encountered by the northern area in general, including the municipalities of Jabalia, Beit Lahia, and Beit Hanun.
According to the Gaza Local Municipalities Council, 25 municipalities are on the verge of complete paralysis due to inability to provide services to residents in light of continued internationally imposed economic embargo since last January's parliamentary elections. This is Rami Al-Maghari reporting from the Umm al-Nasr village in northern Gaza.
During the past week, the Israeli army conducted at least 30 military invasions of Palestinian communities. During these invasions, the army killed 5 Palestinians and abducted at least 60 civilians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Thus, the number of Palestinians abducted by the Israeli army in the West Bank since the beginning of this year has mounted to 861. On Thursday night, Palestinian medical sources at the Al-Makassid Hospital in Jerusalem reported that a Palestinian child died of wounds sustained on Wednesday after Israeli soldiers shot him. At the time he was shot, he was approaching the illegal annexation wall near Ramallah. The child was identified as Mohammed Awaida from Umm al-Sharayat neighborhood in Ramallah. On Thursday morning, Israeli forces invaded the village of Muthalath, south of the city of Jenin, in the northern part of the West Bank, and killed one child. Ahmed al-Assasa, age 16, was hit with a live round in the head and died instantly when Israeli troops opened fire randomly at residents' homes during the invasion. Another two people were injured, Ibrahim Yassin, an ambulance driver who delivered Asasa to the hospital.
We found a 16-year-old child hit with a bullet in his neck behind the ear. His injury was fatal. Apparently, he was extensively bleeding and died immediately after he was shot. Later, the army obstructed the ambulance for a while.
On Wednesday at dawn, at least 40 Israeli army vehicles and several bulldozers invaded Jenin and Jenin refugee camp from multiple directions. In the refugee camp, a group of local resistance fighters from the Al-Aqsa Brigades of Fatah and Al-Quds Brigades of Islamic Jihad clashed with the invading Israeli troops. Iyad Abu Hattab, age 22, a resistance fighter of Al-Aqsa Brigades, was killed during these clashes. Medical sources reported that Israeli soldiers did not allow medical teams to assist the man and left him to bleed for several hours, which led to his death. Later, the army allowed a local ambulance to take the man to Jenin Hospital in the city. Palestinian medical sources in the northern West Bank city of Nablus reported on Tuesday at dawn that two fighters of the Al-Aqsa Brigades, the armed wing of Fatah, were shot and killed by Israeli military fire during an invasion of the city. The sources identify the two fighters as Al-Ziyad Al-Ghalith, age 26, and Muhammad Mreish, age 24. The two were killed during a gun battle with the invading soldiers in the old city of Nablus. Eyewitnesses reported that the two bled for several hours as medical crews could not reach them due to the heavy clashes in the area and the extensive military presence. The clashes took place as dozens of armored military jeeps invaded Nablus and exchanged fire with resistance fighters. On Monday morning, a Palestinian shepherd was found dead near an Israeli settlement located near the city of Nablus. Palestinian sources reported that Mohammed Ben Jaber, age 54, from the village of Akraba, south of Nablus, was found dead near the barbed wire fence of the Itamar illegal Israeli settlement, which is built on the village land. Jaber's family stated that he went missing on Sunday afternoon. Palestinian security sources stated that the man was choked to death and stabbed with a knife several times.
A Palestinian man died on Thursday morning of wounds he sustained on Wednesday when a car he was in was targeted by an Israeli army helicopter in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. Medical sources reported that Ahmad Abu Arda, 20, died of wounds he sustained along with another two people when their car was hit by a missile fired from an Apache helicopter. The car was travelling on a road in Al-Sudaniya in the northern part of the Gaza Strip on Wednesday afternoon. The other two people still lie in critical conditions in Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Palestinian sources stated that the three are members of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of the Islamic Jihad. Israeli media sources reported Israeli army claims that the three were on their way to fire homemade shells at Israeli targets. No shells were found in or near the car, eyewitnesses reported. An undercover Israeli army unit swept early on Tuesday morning into the east of Khan Yunis in the southern region of the Gaza Strip. Palestinian media sources said that the Israeli army unit stormed the area of Farahin under a barrage of heavy gunfire, causing fear and panic among the local residents. The Farahin area has been frequently attacked by the Israeli army since last June. On Monday midday, the Israeli army opened fire at a Palestinian truck while it was driving in Gaza City, Palestinian media sources and medics said. The sources added that armoured Israeli vehicles stationed at the east of Gaza City fired a bombshell at the truck, causing some damage. Medics confirmed that no casualties occurred in the incident. In northern Gaza on Saturday, a Palestinian was shot and wounded by Israeli army gunfire near the Beit Hanun industrial zone. The man was known as Mohammed Abu Warda, 22, and he was admitted to the hospital of Kamal Adwan for treatment.
On Friday, a Palestinian militant was killed and eight others were wounded in an explosion at a military training camp in Khan Yunis City in the southern Gaza Strip. Palestinian sources confirmed that the explosion took place at a training site of the Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas. The explosion apparently took place during the training when a bomb was mistakenly detonated. Earlier in the week, one Palestinian was killed and 19 others injured during infighting in the occupied Palestinian territories, while abducted British journalist Alan Johnston is still being held captive. On Saturday evening, six residents of the southern Gaza Strip city of Khan Yunis were shot and injured, including four members of the same family. According to medical sources, Sami Arafat, age 24, his brother Mohammed, age 18, Hassan Mahmoud Arafat, age 15, Khalil al-Daghma, age 28, and Taysir Arafat, were all shot and injured by unknown gunmen in Khan Yunis. The sources stated that Sami Salam Arafat was the first to be shot by gunmen, and as an ambulance was transferring him to a local hospital, gunmen intercepted it and fired at its passengers, injuring Mohammed and Hassan. The three other civilians were injured in a vehicle that happened to be passing the ambulance. On Sunday, dozens of Palestinian journalists in Gaza protested against the abduction and confinement of BBC reporter Alan Johnston for the second week consecutively. Alan Johnston, the BBC's reporter in Gaza, was kidnapped by unknown gunmen 2 weeks ago. No information is available yet about his whereabouts or the identity or motives of his kidnappers. The protest was held in a marquee in Gaza City. Scores of journalists and representatives of various NGOs and Palestinian factions expressed their objection to the incident.
On Monday, a wounded resistance fighter from the Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, was announced dead in Khan Yunis City in the southern Gaza Strip. The brigades issued a press release stating that Hassan Yusuf, 38, a field leader of the brigades, was killed during a resistance operation on Monday. The press release did not include any further information about the resistance operation. Also on Monday, Palestinian medical sources at Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah, in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, reported that 5 people had been shot and injured during clashes between Hamas and Fatah gunmen. Palestinian security sources reported that the clashes started with a family feud that later led to a gunfight between Fatah and Hamas gunmen. Local sources reported that members of the Islamic Jihad and other factions intervened in the clashes and restored calm to the area. On Wednesday evening, the Fatah and Hamas movements traded exchanges of fire in 2 separate incidents in Gaza, causing the injury of 8 Palestinians. A leader of Hamas's Al-Qassam brigades, his wife, his 2 children and another individual were injured when unknown gunmen fired at the leader's vehicle. In a separate incident, 3 members of the Fatah movements were injured when rounds of live ammunition were fired at them from a speeding vehicle. The 3 were moved to Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. The deteriorating internal security in the Gaza Strip is one of the many challenges facing the recently established National Unity Government in Palestine.
And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, check out our website, www.imemc.org. Thanks for joining us. From Occupy Bethlehem, this is Pauli Ben-Goriad, Ghassan Banoura, and me, Jack Delhami.
In February, 40 Congolese people were rounded up and detained for deportation to the Democratic Republic of Congo. Despite the imminent asylum and immigration tribunal's review of its country guidance for deportation to the Congo, due originally on the 7th of March, which was expected to state that human rights issues in the region are too severe to continue with deportations. Meanwhile, the 40 people have been returned to the Democratic Republic of Congo. The review has been postponed until the 12th of April. Demonstrations were held in response to this at the end of February, and more were held across the UK last Wednesday after 19 Congolese adults and 23 children, all failed asylum seekers, were snatched by Home Office squads in late February. On the 21st of February, over 100 asylum seekers and supporters held a protest outside the Home Office reporting centre in Glasgow. On the 23rd, the group No Borders Brighton protested with a banner drop at the offices of XL Airways in Crawley, and 70 protesters in Leeds gathered at the Home Office Reporting Centre to call for an end to planned deportations. And in Middlesbrough on the 25th of February, a solidarity march was held. Sadly, all the asylum seekers were placed on XL Airways chartered flights and returned to the Democratic Republic of Congo, despite UN reports that week describing the human rights situation there as continuing to deteriorate, with the army and the police perpetuating acts of violence against civilians and increasing numbers of reports of rape. Since 1998, over 4 million lives have been lost in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Though allegedly the war is over, there is not peace. Deaths continue at the rate of 1,200 per week. Recruitment of child soldiers continues. The bishops of Winchester, Chichester, Durham and Ripon have spoken out against the mass expulsion to the DRC. XL Airways have complained they are unable to cope with the number of faxes and calls they have received regarding the flights and have referred everyone to the Home Office. Protesters have attempted to prevent the removals by locking themselves to the gates of Tinsley House Detention Centre in Crawley, where the deportees were held. Solidarity protests were also held outside the Home Office in London. Demonstrations were held last Wednesday in London, Leicester, Manchester, Nottingham, Newcastle, Leeds and Glasgow. Kasper Arami spoke to Innocent MP, who is the Manchester representative of the Congo Support Project.
Can you tell me about how the protests started? I understand that at the end of February there was some action about deportations to Congo. Can you tell me a bit about the background there?
The Congo Support Project started last year in December, and it was founded by a lady called Liz Atherton. They have worked in the last 2 years helping Congolese asylum seekers detention centers in Britain here, and they felt that the situation, the political and social economic situation in the Congo didn't change, and that people came from a lot of atrocities. So it was really important to help them campaign against the deportation because they were being sent back to get there. So in January, we launched the campaign to stop all deportations to Congo in London. And then we started working with Congolese groups and churches around the country. So we are now in the process of building this movement. And we have been so far to Coventry, Birmingham, Manchester, Newcastle, Glasgow. And next week we are going to Cardiff and then to Bradford. So we are hoping that, you know, we will meet every Congolese in every corner of Britain.
Do you know how many people turned up at the protests that were held last week locally?
In Manchester, there were more than 400 Congolese people who came to the protest. So it was a march which started from French Way, which is a notorious prison in Manchester, to the Immigration Tribunal in Manchester Piccadilly Gardens.
And what do you think the future holds for your project? Can you see any changes happening to the situation for the Congolese people who are facing deportation?
Since we have started this project, I think there is a quite positive answer, which is that we try to stop the massive deportation that the Home Office tried to start. On the 26th of February, you know that the Home Office forcibly sent 38 Congolese people back to Kinshasa. And these people were sent back to Kinshasa, but the British Embassy representatives were there to welcome them, and there was representatives from the Congolese government who were there at the airport to welcome them. They left them, they left the airport, they went to the houses, but they were again arrested, imprisoned, tortured, and there are some of them who have fled again the country. So we are thinking that the Home Office is breaching their human rights because they deserve to be granted asylum here, but the Home Office failed to do that, and now they are tortured. Now they have fled again the Congo. So we have to question the Home Office, and we will need an answer. That's why we are carrying on with our campaign, and we are just hoping that, you know, the Home Office will give us a positive answer and help to protect people here.
Finally, does your campaign have a website or any way of contacting it?
We do not have a website yet. We are just building it. If people want to contact us, you know, in Manchester, I'm representing the Congo Support Project, and people can just call me directly on my number, which is 478-7167-6129.
You can find out more details of the Congo deportation protests on indymedia.org.uk under the migration topic heading. And now we have a report from Shepton Mallet. Last year on the Indie Media radio show, when we used to broadcast on Wednesdays, we interviewed Oliver, who was one of a number of tree protests against the building of a Tesco's in Shepton Mallet, which meant that a small forest was going to be cut down. We're speaking with John Bassett of the Save the Senator campaign on the same site. It seems that Tesco's is causing problems again for the people of Shepton Mallet. Hello, are you there, John?
Hello, yes.
So could you tell us a little bit about the Senator? Why is Tesco's making a problem for you?
The Cenotaph is situated very close to the entrance, the service entrance to the Tesco site. And the there's a little roundabout in front of the cenotaph, and around that roundabout, Tesco's delivery vehicles, their HGV delivery vehicles, have to turn to get into the service entrance of the Tesco site, and it's too narrow. They knew this all along. They knew that this roundabout was too small for their HGV vehicles, but they nonetheless submitted a plan, a planning application, for their site, for their supermarket, with using this little roundabout. So now the roundabout has to be widened. It has to be widened, which brings it up right against where the cenotaph, our war memorial, is sited, so that the HGV delivery vehicles will be turning their wheels right across the front of the cenotaph, 18 inches away. Now, this will endanger what is now a listed monument, and has been a monument that has been appreciated now more and more for its what it's worth. But also, it's part of Tesco's long-term plan to get the monument simply removed, so that they can widen the roundabout still further to make it more convenient for themselves. And their plan is that in the next month or so, bound to be with HGV vehicles within 18 inches of the war memorial, that it's going to be struck by one of them.
John, and I understand that a lot of people in Shepton Mallet didn't want the Tesco's. I mean, how did it get planning permission if people objected to the Tesco's being built?
They didn't object to the Tesco, they objected to the destruction of all the trees. These trees were situated at the top end of the town, right just beyond the high street, I mean really close in the centre of the town, and they were very beautiful, particularly this time of the year, and they were very beautiful trees shading the war memorial. So there was a big protest to save the trees, to ask the planning people at Mendip District Council not to give planning permission to destroy these trees. There was a petition of 1,700 signatures, which was a good portion of the town. It's only a small town. And we took those signatures up to the planning board meeting at Mendip District Council to beg the chairman of the planning board to oppose the destruction of the trees. And he didn't even take the signatures on the pieces of paper out of the envelope. He didn't bother with it at all. He made some sarcastic remark. So that was a complete failure. But
so it's a kind of split, really, between local people and big business, would you say?
Well, there's certain ambiguity on this. Some people thought Tesco might be a good idea for the town, might help to revive the town because it's not doing too well at the moment. But the majority opinion is that it will be a disaster for the town, that it will finish off the few remaining shops that still survive.
Okay.
Because Tesco, of course, doesn't like competition.
I see. Well, thank you very much, John. Is there anything that you would like people to contact to save the cenotaph? Is there anything you would like our listeners to do?
Well, we're having a vigil, a Holy Week vigil, starting Wednesday morning, 7 o'clock in the morning, with flowers and candles. It'll be going on for a few days, continuously. People will be sleeping there in front of the war memorial, to remember those young men who died in the two world wars, who are commemorated on the war memorial, a sad number of people, extraordinary number on that war memorial, and also to protest at the really callous and sacrilegious behaviour of Tesco, who don't allow anything, however sacred, to stand in their way. So we would love anybody to support us, ring through or anything like that.
Okay. Do you have a website?
No, we don't, I'm afraid.
Is there a telephone number?
Yeah, well, we've got a telephone number, which is 01749 343 983.
Thank you very much, John.
Okay.
Good luck. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
IndyMedia.org.uk newswire this week was a link to some audio from the first National Union of Journalists Press Photographers Conference held earlier in March. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Commander Bob Broadhurst.
Now, for the last 9-12 months or so, I have the honour, to be perfectly honest, to be the head of public order for the Met. which means that I am responsible, and hence no doubt you will come back to me in the fullness of time, I am responsible for all public order policing in the Met, so demonstrations, marches, protests come under my bailiwick. All ceremonial policing, all sporting events, heavily involved in the planning for the Olympics, the Tour de France that we've got on this year, and of course the training for all those officers, including the territorial support group, the TSG officers that I'm sure you know and love, and who give you lots of copy over the years. Some of it justified, some of it sadly, not quite as good as I would like.
Yes, indeed, a very important senior officer for the Met, and a top dog when it comes to the policing of public events and demonstrations. Commander Bob was the man responsible for the policing of the Sack Parliament action held in Parliament Square in October last year. On the day, about 150 people were held for hours inside a police cordon, and several press photographers were assaulted by the police, including one who subsequently collapsed and was taken to hospital. Here, Commander Bob makes a startling claim.
But we do need order and control. I was talking earlier about the Sack Parliament event. That was a really strange and surreal day. The planning of our opposition, let's call them that, we'd been following with some interest. We were expecting a day of guerrilla warfare. I was fully expecting small groups of 10 or 12 to pop up all over Westminster and doing their best to disrupt Parliament. Lock on to gates, all sorts of other bits and bobs, scaling towers, all sorts. In the end, they fell into the trap, they all came out of the tube at the same time. And you'll remember the pictures there of us corralling them and standing around in a circle, a bit of a standoff, a little bit. Colleagues like yourself had free access in the movement around them. The problem is, so do their photographers, because they've all been photographers in the same way they've all been lawyers, quite rightly so. Our guys and girls cannot differentiate between the people who are out to make mischief and the people who are there generally to take those pictures. We like order and control. And if you look at the television coverage, you see that little push towards the gates of Parliament. A huge swarm of people goes with it. You know, so you've got the people who are trying to disrupt it, corralled by police officers, corralled by another group of people, which is yourselves. Now, to us in a public order sense, that's missing. Who's who within that? Who do we need to be policing out? Who do we need to be giving some sort of rights and access? That's the sort of order from chaos that we try and bring.
Javier responded on the newswire. The comments from Commander Broadhurst are very informative. So, according to him, it is okay to knock out a photographer as long as it is not a professional. Taking pictures to help advocate a political cause or for use as evidence in court cases arriving from political protests is mischief. Basically, there is no difference between the act of blocking a road and the act of documenting and reporting it, unless you are paid for it. Lawyers apparently are also part of the criminal infrastructure necessary for a good political riot. Mike Schwartz, beware. This is very comforting in a way. So-called media activists have long been suffering the disdain of the real activists who actually break things. It was about time that someone as experienced as Mr. Broadhurst in the dirty world of UK street politics vindicated them. Finally, those pesky protesters will realise that media and communications are crucial to any progressive political change. I have been part of the Indie Media Network for a long time, and I am also an NUJ member. Since Indie Media started offering an open publishing platform in 1999, our motto of converting consumer goods into political tools has exploded well beyond activist circles. From YouTube to the awful undercutting of wages through abuse of citizen journalism, the line between journalist, demonstrator, and passerby has been increasingly blurred. Camera size used to be a good indicator of a genuine journalist, but since the fall in prices of digital SLRs, their efficiency as amulets against truncheons has somewhat faded. With mobile phones having the resolution of professional cameras from a couple of years ago, you know you are in trouble. We can then sympathise with the poor Keystone cops trying to hit the baddies and constantly getting it wrong to the amusement of the fake journos who take pictures. The cops themselves must have some self-deprecating sense of humour, given that they flock to indie media to see themselves in action after any public order event. Maybe it is in a reciprocating spirit that police photographers follow independent journalists on their way home from events, taking literally hundreds of close-up pictures of them and their car number plates. Unfortunately, they tend to forget to post them online, so we can all share a laugh at our distressed faces at the time. The question we may ask is why, instead of reducing the civil rights of professional photographers, as Mr. Broadhurst proposes, we don't increase the protection against police intrusion of all citizens to the level currently enjoyed by journalists. Politicians keep talking about the information society and the knowledge economy as if it was just about universal broadband. In that comment, independent journalist Javier referred to Mike Schwartz, another speaker at the conference. Mike Schwartz is a solicitor with a leading human rights practice, and in this excerpt from his speech, he refers to a dodgy practice which Commander Bob's officers have been engaging in.
And sadly, I think that one of the dangers is that the police are using their powers to arrest journalists and photojournalists in order to, first, get material, and second, to get round the protections which are built into the Freedom of Information Act, which are supposed to protect journalistic material. They're arresting journalists, seizing their equipment, treating them as a suspect, looking at their photographs, taking copies, actually turning them to them, taking no further action often, almost always, against journalists, but they've got straight away what they want. And you know, lawyers are coming after the event and saying you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't do that, but the reality on the ground, as you know, is that the police take action, they often get what they want, and allow the lawyers in the courts to try to mop up what's happened afterwards, often after the horse has bolted, because the police have that material. And I think that's one of the trends and areas where there's a real problem. The police arresting journalists and getting their material in order to use it in prosecutions. There are, as I mentioned, more formal mechanisms with more rigorous protections for you, which the police are supposed to use in order to get journalistic material, and I'm sure you know if they think that you have anything of relevance at your office or at your home, they can get a search warrant. They don't have to arrest you, can get a search warrant, and a judge has to approve the grant of a search warrant. If you're not under arrest, they can go to the courts and get a production order requiring you or your superiors or the newspaper to hand over journalism material. And there are protections like the public interest point, which is that a judge has to ensure that there's a public interest in allowing the police access to your material. Public interest overriding the broad interests of access and commercial freedom and freedom of expression. With that public interest, the judge has to be satisfied, override your interests. And so you can see that there are court mechanisms for protecting your journalistic material. And as I said before, my worry is that those mechanisms are being sidetracked or avoided in some instances by arrests of journalists as a shortcut to getting material.
It isn't often that we get to hear the words of the likes of Commander Bob, and his talk certainly highlights some of the concerns about policing in the age of the so-called war on terror. When a commander starts briefing riot cops that a protest is going to be guerrilla warfare, it's no wonder that they then overreact and end up hospitalizing an independent photographer on the day. Although one might imagine that the job of police is to identify the baddies, their commander justifies the harassment of every individual in the area on the basis that the cops are not up to the job, i.e. that they cannot tell the innocent from those who are committing offences. The solicitor, Mike Schwartz, identifies a new practice of circumventing legal protections for journalists by arresting people with cameras so that the images from their cameras can be stolen and used in trials, regardless of whether they are accredited journalists or not. Once the images have been seized in this dodgy manner, arrestees can then be released without charge. As Javier noted, the falling cost of the technology needed to produce images, footage and audio have enabled ordinary people to be the media, and indeed footage from ordinary cameras has often played a crucial role in the acquittal of people wrongly arrested at actions and demos. In the 21st century, you can be corralled for hours without even the basic protection that PACE gives arrestees, because the police are acting on sexed up and incorrect intelligence fed to them by the likes of Commander Bob. Full audio from the conference can be found at www.epuk.org/audio_files. I repeat, www.epuk.org/audio_files. And links, as always, from the Newswire on www.indymedia.org.uk. This is FTP for Indie Media Global Report on Resonance 104.4 FM.
Okay, and now we're going to be speaking to Des K, although I keep thinking he's called Daz Key. We've got Des K on the line, and he was one of the petitioners in the High Court against the banning of critical mass, or the turning of critical mass, the once monthly bike ride in London, into being classed by police as a protest. Hello, Des, are you there?
I certainly am.
Do you mind me calling you Daz if I get it wrong?
Daz, well, it'll give you a clean image anyway.
Well, I understand that you had a High Court victory and the critical mass is not viewed as a protest, so isn't the rules of protest do not apply to critical mass because it's a bunch of people riding bikes around London. There's no limit on the number of people that can ride bikes together. So what is the problem at the moment?
Well, unfortunately, it was seen as a protest, and it was only because it was considered commonly and customarily held that we got away with it, because there's a loophole in the legislation. Is that how you say it?
Legislation.
Yes. That meant that any events that happen in a very cyclical basis are able to do it without police permission. So that was really why we got away with it. But in the appeal, what was argued was that for something to be commonly or customarily held, it has to have the same route each time. And it was a rather persuasive argument for the judges by the sort of atmosphere of the day. So it doesn't look like, it looks like ultimately that they may win through with this.
The problem with this is it could be illegal for people to ride their bicycles in large groups around London.
Oh, absolutely. It could indeed. As it's illegal for get a few people to gather around the Houses of Parliament without permission. So it's another way of eroding our civil liberties. It seems to be such an atmosphere of wanting to control everything, which is, you know what happens, the tighter people hold on to things, the more things slip through their fingers. So, You know, I mean, although this is the intentions, I'm not sure whether there's going to be any results for them.
Is it possible? Bikes are traffic, right? So could a traffic jam be declared an illegal gathering?
Yes, indeed. Well, I'm sure all these things will get argued in court. Seems to lawyers lots of money. So we'll wait and see what happens, really. It's a bit of a tricky one. And we're not so sure whether or not it's going to make any difference, even if they win over on this. Because, you know, there are no organisers. It's a tradition that takes place in over 300 different cities around the world every last Friday of the month. So it can't be, you know, nobody can actually be considered an organiser as such.
So when you took the case to the High Court, it was more that you felt your civil liberties in regard to riding a bicycle, how you wanted to, with who you wanted to, were under threat.
Absolutely. And it's rather crazy, really, if you think about it. You know, I mean, bicycles are such a way forward, and there's going to be a time when they're going to just take up absolute priority on the streets. I had this vision of kind of traffic lights that were fenced cyclists and turned green immediately so that cyclists didn't actually have to stop anywhere. After all, you know, why shouldn't we get the priority on the streets of London and anywhere else? It's the way forward, and it's, you know, it's obviously...
Do you think a lot of this... There's a lot of cycle hatred in a lot of the free newspapers, like those kind of London papers that get handed out at tube stations. A friend of mine was actually attacked on his bike. He was riding his bike out in Essex, and somebody grabbed the handlebars of his bike, and I think they pulled him along. And he was unconscious on the side of the road with severe head injuries, and the police regard it as a serious assault.
Absolutely. But there again, I think that's more ethics for you than, you know... I don't think when it comes down to individuals, I mean, I think people are kind of riding on this tide of change now and are beginning to see things differently. And I think the attitude to cycling and cyclists is in the process of change. And you know, it's up to people like us and people who really want to try and get a decent future for our children to just keep on keeping on and do what we can. And thankfully, there's millions of people out there who are.
So, are you doing anything about this appeal?
Well, we're waiting to see what the results are first before we can do anything. I think we then just have to discuss various options. I mean, we could just carry on the way we are, and it could cause this kind of surreal situation where the person in the front of the mass would be arrested as the leader. But I mean, it's just, you know, the whole thing would just get laughed out of court, I reckon.
Well, randomly you end up at the front of the mass. You never know, because sometimes you misjudge the speed of the thing and your legs are longer than someone else's.
Precisely.
Well, listen, thanks very much. Thanks for speaking to us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So the critical mass is the last Friday of every month.
And we meet underneath Waterloo Bridge outside the National Film Theatre.
Could you describe for listeners your amazing bike?
My amazing bike?
Yeah.
Well, I suppose it stands out a little bit from the others because it's a recumbent bike, but it's got all sorts of various bits and pieces that I've accumulated together, and it's connected up to the pedals, so there's different things that move about, and makes it a little bit more interesting for people.
And you've got very big horn, haven't you?
Well, I didn't really want to get personal, but one has to draw attention to what we're doing. And I mean, the amazing thing is most people just love to see us all riding through the streets and you know, just give us lots of support and cheering. So it's pretty good. And if you're a novice cyclist, come on out. I mean, if you're worried about riding through the streets of London, see what it feels like riding with a whole mass of other cyclists. It's really good fun, and we chat together. There's no traffic noise. It's a wonderful experience. Wonderful.
Okay. Thanks very much, Des Daz. Bye-bye.
Pleasure.
Bye.
Bye now.
And now we have Free the Peeps in the studio on a report back from the Reclaim the Futures party. Do you want to give us the lowdown on what happened at the Reclaim the Futures party and where it happened and why it happened?
Okay, well, we've heard how they don't like groups of people doing demonstrations. They don't like people photographing people doing demonstrations. They don't like people riding bikes in large groups. So it's going to come as no surprise that they don't like parties either. And Saturday was Reclaim the Futures. It's the fourth one. It's a party which is a big thing in the activist movement in London. It's a fundraiser for a number of campaigns. It's also a day where there's workshops where people can come along and be introduced to ideas, be introduced to campaigns. There's info stalls, there's vegan cafes, there's cabaret, there's music, there's dancing. You know, a good time can be had by all. This year it was in a squatted building in Holloway Road, and hundreds and hundreds of people turned up. We had workshops in the afternoon, a cafe after that, and then the build-up to the party. From the start, the event was scheduled to begin at 1 o'clock. At 3 minutes past 1, the police pulled up outside the gate. That was when it became obvious that they weren't very happy with the idea of it.
How many police pulled up
at that stage?
Gate?
It was one car with four police in it, and they hung around for a while, and then they were replaced by a mobile CCTV van, which sat there for the afternoon filming people as they came in and out. And at about 5 o'clock, coming up for 6 o'clock, the fire brigade arrived with a whole bunch of police officers who'd being concerned for the public safety of the activists that they harass all year long, had called in the police, had called in the fire brigade so that they could come and ensure our public safety. The police love public safety. They hate bike rides, though. So the fire brigade came in. They made them shut off a central room in the building, which created chaos because suddenly a whole lot of toilets had been lost and the route through the center of the building had been lost. So people were milling around. Everyone was confused about where to go. This was the helpful intervention from the authorities, but we complied with everything that the fire brigade asked, so the party went on. More people arrived. Come midnight, there's at least 1,000 people. You've got hundreds of people inside. You've got 200-300 people outside waiting to get in, and seven bobbies come and plant themselves in between the 300 trying to get in and all the ones inside, and they declare no one else is coming in tonight. 10 minutes later, there's people coming over high walls, there's people coming over roofs. They've created chaos once again. But you'll hear Bob Broadhurst on that audio telling you, we love order. They created chaos. They closed down Holloway Road on a Saturday night for 2 hours while they stood there pushing people around. They didn't go into the party. They didn't take any rigs. No one knew where they were there or what they were doing. And after 2 hours, they got in their vans, and they drove away, and the party finished when everybody was ready to go home.
But did they shut the music down?
They didn't shut the music down, although in the end the rigs left about 3:30.
So it was a great party, apart from the interference by the forces of order.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great example of do-it-yourself culture. It was the creation of a temporary autonomous zone, which is always a joyous thing to be involved in. But they don't understand it, and they certainly can't deal with it.
Okay, well, we're about out of time now, so thanks, Free the Peeps. Thanks to all the contributors to the show. They're not all in the studio. Coming up in about 30 seconds and just sneaking in the door like a creature of the night, we have Mr. Hour of the Apocalypse. I'm fine, and he's coming in with a bunch of CDs. Now, thanks for listening to the show. Do keep posting your campaign reports to indymedia.org.uk, but not just to indymedia.org.uk, to any kind of alternative media where you can get your voice out and be heard. That's the most powerful thing. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.